This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Keeping the conversation going.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Will Jacinta Allen's exit make this a more civilised election campaign ahead? Or are we in for an ugly ride? And if so, why? Yes, I'm Mary Guerin. This is the Conversation Hour, and I'd love to speak with you today about what you think 23 hours ago. It's been a long 23 hours. We told you of that breaking news of Ben Carroll's ascent to the role of Premier. Now, so much of the analysis since has centred on what Chip LeGrand told us on the Conversation Hour yesterday, the loathing for Jacinta Allen, quote unquote, that MPs just couldn't get around when they were door knocking. Whether that animus was around her being a proxy for Daniel Andrews, whether it was about gender, whether it was about the big build, we heard from so many of you different theories about any of those factors. That was that ugliness around it. She was a lightning rod for vitriol. But now that this rod is out of the picture, will that make the campaign less febrile? What do you think? Or is this the new normal? This morning, I'll be speaking with some longtime observers of the political scene to get their thoughts. One of them thinks it's almost un-Victorian to have ugly discourse. What do you think? Is that naive? Or is that just the way of the world at the moment? This social media particularly driven world? Or are we conflating genuine anger with, whether it be Labor or the political class or everything, are we conflating anger with that talk about ugly discourse? Tell me what you think. Will Jacinta Allen's exit take some of that away? Also on the Conversation Hour this morning, what's the unofficial tourist attraction where you live? Because I'm going to bring you a new official attraction for Victoria. If you're a bird watcher with eyesight problems in particular, this is the attraction for you. It's apparently the world's biggest king parrot sculpture. It's in Eildon Primary School. It's quite specific, isn't it? The world's biggest king parrot sculpture. Our regional listeners, I know, are all over this, but I am now letting the Melbourne folk know, because if they want to go a couple of hours up the highway, they can see it. I want to hear from you. What's the unofficial tourist attraction where you live? I live in Brunswick, and I can tell you around those parts, it's undoubtedly the op shops. I'm not quite sure that's on any official marketing, but I can tell you, it works for Brunswick. Is it, what is it in your world? Is it a cafe? Is it a garden? Is it a piece of street art? I'd love to hear from you. What are the things we should be travelling to your town or suburb to see? All of that and lots more to chat about in the Conversation Hour. But first, the biggest news of the week and really the year so far, at least when it comes to state politics. And will Jacinta Allen's exit make this a more civilised election campaign?
This is the Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Tell me what you think. Are we still in for an ugly ride in this election campaign? We're still just absorbing this news about Jacinta Allen. What do you think about what was behind that animus and what could take that away? Joining me now to talk about the election campaign ahead, what might work for Ben Carroll, what would cut through, does he have enough time as well? And this question about the nature and the tone of the campaign. Paul Strangio joins me, as he did yesterday, Emeritus Professor of Politics at Monash University. And also on the line is Andrea Carson, Professor of Political Communication at Melbourne University and also the Director of the Melbourne University's Centre for Advancing Journalism. Thank you so much for joining me, both of you.
Hi, Mary. Hi, Andrea.
Good morning. I'll go to you first, Paul. You were joining us in the maelstrom yesterday as things were breaking all over the place. We've had some time to absorb it. We were talking yesterday in part about what has led Jacinta Allen to this place, what's led the Labor Party to this place, and it was mentioned this quote-unquote loathing of Jacinta Allen. What's your view on what the nature of that was? Some people talk about gender, some people talk about proxy to Daniel Andrews. What's your theory?
Look, I think it's obviously difficult to separate all the different contributing factors out, which was the principal one. The first thing to say is I've looked at the polling and, you know, she became Premier in September 2023. At no point did the electorate really extend much goodwill to her. She actually never obtained a positive rating in terms of leadership, and it was a pretty steep decline from 2024 onwards. My own sense is that as much as anything, she did become a proxy for loathing for Daniel Andrews. Daniel Andrews, and that he loomed over everything she did. Daniel Andrews, this titan of Victorian politics, this three-time election winner by significant large margins, became by the latter stages of his premiership a magnet of hostility, complete with conspiracy thinking. And I strongly think when he walked away in September 2023, a lot of antagonism was displaced and placed on Jacinta Allen's shoulders.
And she just couldn't shake it off.
Yeah, she couldn't shake it off, in part because of her incapacity to develop a leadership in her own identity, and obviously the big build stuff and her unwillingness to meet that and her digging in. Why she dug in is itself a very intriguing question. People suggest it was Daniel Andrews behind the scenes pulling strings. I don't know about that, but
wheels within wheels at that point.
Yeah, wheels within wheels, that's right.
Andrea Carson, do you agree with that about what sort of lay behind this animus?
Yeah, I think Paul's outlined some of the key points there. The other points that I would add to that was it was very hard for Jacinta Allen to separate herself from Daniel Andrews. She was deputy to him and he effectively anointed her from the same faction as well, and she was Minister of both the Commonwealth Games and the Big Build, and this was part of the baggage that she was carrying with both of those, having some serious misgivings with allegations of the Big Build corruption, and then, of course, the cancelling of the Commonwealth Games. And it's kind of ironic timing that her demise, political demise, is at the same time that Australia is leading the tally board at the Com Games, of which has been paid for by Victorian money. So
rubbed it in a bit.
I think there's a lot for Victorians to be questioning with Jacinta Allen's leadership.
I'll come back to you, Andrea Carson, on the gender point in just a moment, but Pat from Benalla wanted to join the conversation. Hi, Pat. What did you want to say?
Hello. I'd just like to say that, you know, people, not the Labor Party and some of the presenters on 774, they've got a negative outview on them, but think of the good things that they've done for Victoria. 1939 in England, they had an underground railway. It took us from 1939 to 2026 to build one. It's the good things that they've done. They've done a lot of bad things, but focus on the good things too.
Pat, thank you for calling. Really good to get that, and I'd love for people to call in 1300 222 774 to add your thoughts as we're still absorbing this from 23 hours ago. Andrea Carson is with me, as is Paul Strangio. Andrea, I just wanted to ask you your point. You've done some research around this element of gender. What did you find? What do you think it was the case for Jacinta Allen?
Well, my research has looked at women's representation in politics, and we know that both men and women cop a lot of abuse online, trolling and so forth, and also offline as well. The difference between men and women is that there's a gendered element to the abuse that women get that refers directly to their gender, which men don't tend to get. And so Jacinta Allen also would have been getting that level of getting some of those negative aspects of public life just as influencers and other celebrities also cop that. So it's very difficult to separate out the casual misogyny as well as benevolent misogyny that occurs and unconscious bias. But this was a government also that had a concerted effort to elevate women. It had a majority of women in its upper house. It had reached near parity. So there were many efforts to try and bring up women's representation in politics. And she was our second female premier.
We're talking today about whether or not we're going to have a more civilised election campaign now that Jacinta Allen, who is controversial for a lot of people, has exited the scene. Paul Strangio, what's your point of view about that? What do you believe is the nature of the discourse in Victoria, and what do you think could happen now that Jacinta Allen is gone?
Look, I think, I've emphasised, the legacy of Daniel Andrews, which is displaced on to Jacinta Allen. At the same time, we do have to balance with that. We are dealing with a third-term government that's trying to win four terms. Cain and Colonel weren't able to do that. Braxton Brumby weren't able to do that. Governments do accumulate baggage. They accumulate grievance. So there's no doubt there's part of that playing out, accumulated grievance over time. But I think that is now being all superimposed. It's being hyped up by the changes in politics that we talk about endlessly, the social media and so forth, and Andrew knows all this stuff very well, that is debasing the currency of politics and making, community debates extraordinarily difficult, civil community debates, ones in which you can have genuine exchanges of different viewpoints.
Do you think it's baked in now? This is the new normal, as they say.
I think to some degree now it is the new normal, and I think the combination of the genuine anger about the government's levels of mismanagement and the very peculiar dynamic of the hostility to Daniel Andrews and the legacy of it, and then combined, all coming together, is making for a particularly toxic brew come this November. And as I've said, I think the interesting question is now whether Ben Carroll's elevation can in any way dissipate that. He does seem someone who exudes a level of calmness, and maybe even can bring a degree of dignity. But whether he can, in 3 or 4 months, change the nature of the conversation in Victoria, is highly debatable.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that time frame in a moment. You're on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Sarah, you're in the CBD. What do you think?
I think a lot of the problem with Jacinta Allen was her inability to actually constructively engage. I mean, she was, any time that anybody said anything that was critical or querying, she got really defensive and aggressive. And, I think a classic example of that was when the previous leadership pressure, and all she said was they were a bunch of scallywags in need of a cuddle. I mean, I think everybody felt that, I certainly felt that she was condescending and non-consultative and not actually, it was either her way or no way at all. And I think maybe Ben Carroll could learn a lot from that, and actually it doesn't necessarily have to be more consultative, but at least he has to appear that he's being more consultative and aware of criticism.
Sarah, thank you. Lack of consultation. Yeah, do you agree? James in Daylesford, you've got a theory as to why Jacinta Allen was this lightning rod?
Oh, I think, hi. Thanks for that, taking my call. I think I don't agree with your guess completely, because you've got to remember Dan Andrews won an election with a record popularity. I supported Dan Andrews. I always have supported Labor. And I gave Jacinta Allen gave her time to see what she's like. But there's a number of things she's done and been arrogant and intransient, whether it's on animal welfare or whether it's on the emergency services levy, or a whole lot of stuff. that's what turned people off slowly. Mm. So it wasn't a hanger-on from Dan Andrews, because I liked him, but I for the last 12 months I've been encouraging my local member to encourage her to go.
So. James, thank you. Interesting to get that perspective as well. And Alan, you're in Albury Wodonga. You wanted to join the conversation?
Yeah, thank you very much. Look, I just want to take a quick leap out of the current scenario and put it at a broader level, and that is, look, we're based in Albury Wodonga. We've had significant businesses in Victoria. We've sold up everything in Victoria over the last few years of the journey. Been involved with a lot of corporate work and litigation and company, etc. Mm. The point I'm making, the political level doesn't create an entry system that creates a level of accountability on any level, or even experience in relation to the job roles that they take up. Now,
you're talking about what they've done before they get into politics, Alan? Or what happens once they get in?
Before as well. I mean, if you take, the public sector, as a director of a company, the level of accountability is astonishing.
I mean, sorry to interrupt you, Alan, but I'm guessing that they would say, look, you've been about 4 months, comes the ultimate accountability test. Your vote.
Well, it's not so much that. You can become a politician literally on the back of a wordy packet based on the voting consensus of your local area. I
mean, Alan, thank you for joining the conversation. We're sort of pushing up against it, so I'm sorry we can't continue, but it's interesting theory as well. We are talking about what's going to happen in terms of this next 4 months. 4 months, we're told that a week is an eternity in politics. What does 4 months mean? Paul Strangio and Andrea Carson are still on the line. Andrea, what you've looked at as well in your research is looking at this particularly news-averse electorate that we've got. So many more of us are not tuning in to all of the comings and goings of the political class. Is 4 months enough time? We've heard about the challenges there for Ben Carroll to rebrand, I hate that word, but to do the things that will cut through to differentiate himself enough to win?
I'd be a brave person who would predict the outcome. And as you say, 4 months is, a week's an eternity in politics. And so 4 months is some time to get some runway. While people are turning off from traditional sources, and I apologise, Mary, for getting politics, survey work shows that we're becoming actually more politically engaged.
Right.
But it's in a very fragmented landscape, which is across podcasts, influencers, messaging, peer-to-peer messaging, all the different ways that we get it. And the other side of this is the way that politicians and parties themselves use the digital landscape. It's very cheap for advertising. They use Facebook and Instagram in order to segment their audiences to reach different age groups. We know that the under 35s are on Instagram. The under 24s are on TikTok. The above 50s are likely to be on Facebook. They're using all those affordances to be able to get their messages out. This will be a campaign on steroids. In fact, it's already going on. We know that Jacinta Allen was doing the door knocking within her own electorate. She was obviously concerned. Andrew Leeslian, who contested at the federal level, had almost a 10% swing to him, almost won that electorate at the federal level. He's now smack bang going for the state. The same seat but within the state, up against Jacinta Allen. So the campaigning had already begun before we had the events of yesterday, and now it will really ramp up. And seeing Ben Carroll in front of Kmart is some of the visual cues today that he's giving off about how he wants to be known, that he's a grassroots guy, he's come from a modest background. All that signaling's beginning, and just look at your Insta feed and your Facebook feed, you'll start seeing lots of political ads running through.
Best marketing for that shop for a while, I'm sure. Or do people agree with that? Andy, you're in Dali. What did you want to say?
Oh, yeah, look, to start us, look, I'm a Labor supporter, but I think what's happened with Jacinta Allen, or at least under her watch, and I think I say this probably on behalf of 90% of the people I know that are fellow Victorians, fellow from Melbourne. Under her watch, the crime scene has just become so bad that people don't even want to live in Melbourne anymore. And, you know, like then she said, oh, we're going to change these bail laws and et cetera, et cetera. Mm. But then there's people getting killed and macheted and
Sorry, Andy, to interrupt, but do you think that Ben Carroll can do enough in the next 4 months to convince you that he'll be across it?
Like was mentioned earlier on the air there, Ben Carroll does have a sense of calmness about him, which I do like. And there tends to be a sense of arrogance a little bit with the Liberals and with the One Nation. Mm. So maybe that might hold in. I think it's really going to come down to who's going to actually be able to convince people that Melbourne's going to be a better place to live.
That Melbourne's going to be a better place to live. One of the many things that will be ramping up over the next 4 months. Thank you so much, Paul Strangio and Andrea Carson. I'm sure as these things do ramp up, we will be having you back on the Conversation Hour.
Thanks, you, Mary. Thank you, Paul.
Strangio from Monash University and Andrea Carson from Melbourne University. This is the Conversation Hour. Keep those calls and texts coming because, yes, I want to hear from you about what you think the next 4 months hold and what would be the thing that does cut through with you. Keep those conversations coming. Also later on the Conversation Hour, 24-hour long flights are ever closer. What could possibly go wrong on a 24-hour flight? I'd love to hear from you about that. But next, you might be into bird watching. Are you into big bird watching? There's news for you.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Here's a question for you. What is the unofficial tourist attraction where you live? As I said, around me, it's op shops. But what is it for you? 1300 222 774. What would you travel to see? Would it be a 4 meter tall king parrot? A 4 meter tall king parrot sculpture has been unveiled at Eildon Primary School. Our regional listeners know all about it, but I'm introducing it to our Melbourne listeners because they can go and see it in a day trip. To talk to us about what was behind this, what we can be expecting if we do make that trip, is Corinne Haslam, who's Eildon Events former president, and the artist behind the sculpture, Tank. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for the opportunity to chat about it.
If I can tell people, if you go to your favourite search engine and look up 4 metre king parrot, you will be able to see a beautiful, colourful, as I say, 4 metre tall king parrot. Corinne, first to you, what was the thinking behind this?
The main reason that we put the king parrot is Eildon, a lot of people come to Eildon in the summer. The winter, it's very quiet. After COVID, same as most of a lot of country towns, we were suffering. A lot of our shops were shut. We wanted to have something to draw people that weren't necessarily fishermen or boat people to Eildon. King parrots are all over the place and people love them. They're such a beautiful, vibrant bird. And we had seen work from Tank and Tobin before and just had about 2 years ago, Kerry, who is on the committee, and myself had a little bit of a brainwave. I said, how about if we get a king parrot? They're bright, they're beautiful, it would attract attention, and it would draw people, we believe, into Eildon. Originally, it was only going to be a 2 metre king parrot.
Mm-hmm.
But then we spoke to a few of the locals because this has been totally funded by community. There is no state or local government support at all with this. And I'll take the opportunity to thank the Eildon Primary School for allowing us to put it on the property, because I'll go into that in the detail in a little minute.
Mm.
The Eildon Community Opportunity Shop, AGL, and Edwards Built Family Houseboats. Obviously,
so they all got behind it and they decided that 2 metres wasn't enough, you needed four.
No, it was actually myself and Kerry that decided if we're going to go for it with all the support that we were getting, we would spend the extra money, and obviously Eildon Events were initiating this, that with the support of others, we could afford the bigger parrot. This was about 2 years ago when we first thought of it, but the biggest hurdle we had, it wasn't raising the funds or having the bird made, it was finding a home for it.
Right.
And initially we thought with the new splash park and skate park, we could put it there. And that's close to the shopping centre, so it would be ideal.
Mm.
But unfortunately, with council restrictions, that wasn't an option.
You couldn't. And now it's in the primary school, and I just, you know, all I can think of is kids crawling all over it. I'll ask you about that in a second. 1300 222 774. Tell me about what people are coming to your suburb or your town to see. I'd love to hear. Here is your chance to spruik it. 1300 222 774. What should we be travelling to see where you live? Corinne Haslam is with me talking about the origins of the 4 metre king parrot, and Tank, the artist behind this parrot, is on the line as well. Tank, I'll come to you now. So you were commissioned to do this 2 and then 4 metre tall parrot. What did you think when you got this job?
Well, we're always wrapped to build another sculpture. You know, we've over the years we've put in the big magpie and Euroa and got Rosella in Cobram and good birds everywhere. Berrigan, Strathmerton, got down in Tarneit in Melbourne. And
are there any as large as this one?
We've got probably our biggest would be up on the Murray. It's Yulupner Island, and it's a 6 metre wedge-tail eagle. So we have got a. They're all mapped on Google, and you know we sort of started wanting to get a bit of a sculpture trail going alongside the silo trail that everyone knows so well now.
Yeah, that's right. And again, something that people travel for. You also, with all of your works, try to go into recyclable materials. Is that right?
Yeah, as much as possible. They're not 100%, but and we do some trendy sort of looking farm art as well that is 100% recyclable stuff. But wherever we can, we'll use recycled materials. And so we've got there's some visible recycled materials, some really thick old chain that we've used for the king parrot's feet and things like that, and all the tree that he's sitting in is all out of recycled metal. So we see that as important, and to hold on to some of these things, you know, just about to look at this, the thickness of this chain and stuff like that, is we find that that's an important thing.
And 1300 222 774, if you'd like to join this conversation about the attractions in your town or suburb. Corinne, I was talking about its placement being in Eildon Primary School, which you eventually settled on. I have to ask, yes, is it off limits to climbing kids?
Look, it's very safe in itself. It's within the school grounds, but it is the grounds are segregated. There's chain and posts to keep it, basically you get to it straight off the street.
So can people come and take photos there without involving the kids, etc.?
Yes, absolutely. The beautiful thing, there's already synergy there, because the school colours for the Eildon Primary School were influenced by the King Parrot. And also, their new playgroup is called the Little Parrots. So it's really quite cute.
Oh, that is cute. I must ask, does the parrot have a name?
He certainly does. His scientific name is Alasteris scapularis. And we put a competition out to the community to say, okay, what do you think this parrot should be called? And they came up with lots of different names. But one that was quite popular was, it's got to be Alistair, surely, just a short version of Alasteris. So we have Alistair, the King Parrot.
Corinne, I'm so thrilled that you were able to get that through, as you said, through community support as well. I'd love to take a trip to see it. Thank you so much for joining me today, and you as well, Tank. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mary.
thanks for the opportunity. That's... Come and see this beautiful sculpture.
Go and see Alistair. That is there in the Eildon Primary School grounds, but separate. Tank is the artist and Corinne Haslam is the Eildon Events former president. And this on text, the parrot looks good. It's in a great spot. Well done. That's from Andrew on text. Well, from flightless birds, I think we can call Alistair that, to 24-hour flights. What could possibly go wrong? That's next on The Conversation Hour. I would love to hear what could go wrong on a long-haul flight. Tell me about your experiences, what's gone wrong on your long-haul flight, because we have had this, we think, record-breaking journey from Melbourne to Toulouse in France. Would you go on one flight all that way? Also coming up later in The Conversation Hour, sprinting records falling in Glasgow. And that's something to celebrate as well. You're on The Conversation Hour.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
24 hours and 24 minutes. That's how long the flight was, the longest ever commercial flight, we think, between Melbourne and Toulouse. That just happened yesterday. Cecile from Montmorency, you're going to make this same journey from Melbourne to Toulouse yourself. Are you going on one of these flights?
Well, I wish I had known, because it could have been a lot easier than having to stop about three times. Although I think my body might not thank me about sitting in the same seat for 24 hours.
So how long will your Melbourne Toulouse trip be?
It's actually only, if you time it well, about 35 and a half hours. So
really?
This time I'm going via Singapore and Munich. So yeah, depending on...
I love being an Antipodean, saying it's just 35 hours. So tell me, Cecile, why wouldn't you go on a one flight for 24 hours and 24 minutes? What's your top fear about that?
I think it would be just the sitting in those seats for that long. And yes, you can get up and stuff, but unless they come with their own little private treadmills or something, I think it would be, I'm getting older and my body would not thank me. But otherwise, it's appealing in the sense that if I could sleep for half of that, I don't think that I would mind so much.
Absolutely, Cecile. I completely agree with you. What would it take to be, or maybe a little private sauna, something, at least a bed. What would it take for you to get on a 24-hour flight? I'd love to hear from you. 1300 222 774. Here to talk about it with us is Chris Zapponi, who's the aviation writer for The Age, who's looking at this trick that the aviation companies are, the airlines are doing to make this come into being for all of us every day. This is their plan, flights every day. Chris, how significant is this particular flight that happened this week?
Well, I mean, in terms of record setting, it could be very significant, because it's been a while since we've seen a plane set a record like this. I mean, if this is confirmed, 24 hours in the sky is a long time. The closest to that was a flight in 2005 that went for 22 hours and 42 minutes. I think that ran from Hong Kong to London. Mm. So this is quite a big deal.
And this is part of a plan, right? I mean, this has been coming down the track, this sort of commercial venture. There's obviously people thinking that there's a market for it.
That's right. That's right. So this has been Qantas's plan for some time. It was disrupted a bit by COVID, but they have, according to their own research and what they see in sort of consumer taste, they think that there's a market for people who will hop on a plane in Sydney and fly direct to London or fly direct to New York with no stop. And that's quite a long flight, but they see that, you know, they have customers that are doing this, going from, say, Perth to Rome. They're going Perth to Paris. So this is just nudging it a bit higher. Instead of 17 or 18 hours, we're going up to 20 hours, 22 hours, depending on the winds. And, you know, according to their best research, there will be this sort of, you know, top of the market that will do this. And to be sure, these planes are not just, you know, first class and business class. They have economy seating as well.
Mm. Tell us, what would get you onto a 24-hour flight? What do you feel would be the worst thing to happen on a long-haul flight? Or tell me your worst experiences on any long-haul flight, 1300 222 774. Chris, tell me about what a plane needs to be like. If we're not going to get what Cecile and I want, which is basically a little bed, you know, what how are they fitted out? Are there any specific features that go with this length of trip?
Well, what makes this plane, this so-called Project Sunrise, what makes it interesting is that they have really sort of looked at the science of travel and of sleep and of jet lag and of circadian rhythms and how people adjust to this. So some of the things that they have planned for this plane, so it's especially adapted A350, Airbus 350, is that it'll have a wellness zone where people can do sort of stretching and sort of yoga type things and stretch their limbs when they're you know, stuck in these seats. It will also have this lighting that's designed to sort of get your body onto the time zone of the country that you're going to. And it's very subtle, but it seems like it could be a very interesting aspect of this, because if you can sort of get into the groove of how this mode of transportation works, you can kind of go with the flow. And by the time you arrive, you should be, you know, in better shape scientifically, I think, than you would be with other planes that don't have these sorts of features.
Yes, why can't we have them on all the flights, I would say? Someone's pointing out we already have those 20-hour flights already to London. That's from Perth. Is that right? It was 20 hours? And in which case, is there much of a difference between those planes that are going there and this one?
Well, this plane, so this new model that's specially made for this Qantas requirement goes about 1,000 miles further. And that gives it that extra reach. I think if you talk to Qantas, they say they are, in a sense, training. Maybe that's not the right word, but they're finding passengers who are already used to these long flights, 17 hours, 18 hours. So to bolt on another 3 or 4 hours, it's not that big a deal. I mean, I think if you're used to very short flights, Melbourne, Sydney, to go and do a 20-hour flight, 22-hour flight would be a big leap. But as you know, so many people in Australia, for us, flying is automatically 13 hours or 12 hours
exactly.
Or 15 hours. So it's not that, you know, this is the right market for this.
But we do like to stretch our legs in those stopovers. 1300 222 774, what would get you onto a 24-hour flight? Is this a problem that you've always wanted someone to solve? Manny says, of course I would do it first class, that is. Someone else on text, Chris, asks, how on earth do they manage staff over 24 hours? I'm assuming that's something that's had to be looked at, even with these 20-hour flights.
Yes, that's right. In the planes, they have, you know, obviously on these long haul flights, they have spaces for the crew to take breaks, to rest. And they have sort of longer blocks of time for people to rest, or crew to rest, so that they stay refreshed and that they're capable of taking care of the passengers and to fly the plane. I mean, this is something, again, part of the science that they had to look at, because these are very long flights. They have to make sure that the intervals that people are on deck and the downtime that they have corresponds to that sort of longer schedule. But yes, this is all sort of factored into the plane and into the refit and the redesign of this particular A350.
This question as well on text for you, Chris. Any idea of the price compared to the usual flights? It's true. Is it cheaper because they need to get you on to prove the theory, or is it more expensive? This is just a test flight. Is that right? Or were there passengers?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. No, these flights will not be commercially available until 2027, if all goes well in terms of production and all that. But
what do you expect then about the price after that point?
Well, they're looking at a premium, I've heard, of up to about 20%. So the expectation that people will pay that, and, you know, they're looking at some of these sort of core demographics where people will pay, you know, they'll pay that extra to get that one flight back to London. I know there's a debate where people say, look, I'd like to go through the hub. I like to go through Singapore, or maybe in another time going through the Middle East. That's probably going to be part of the equation as well. Some people, they like to stretch their legs and they like to have, you know, a little bit of an excursion between flights. So that will be something that I imagine the market will sort of determine over time. But there does seem to be a certain number of people that would do this flight and then have it all done. You get on the plane, you watch whatever, 7 movies, 8 movies, whatever, and then you a box set, and then you land.
A whole series. You've got Succession. It went for a few years,
right,
didn't it?
That's right.
Chris Zappone is with us. We're talking about test flight, 24 hours, 24 minutes. This is the way of the future, apparently. And, Chris, we've been talking about this plan. This has been in the offing for a while. Clearly, there's a business plan that's been coming, but it's sort of found its moment in modern history, hasn't it? This is where politics and so forth have really made this more relevant than we might have thought when the first time this was thought of.
True, true. I mean, I think when it was announced, it was seen as a bit of a novelty, and it was sort of a solution to a problem that a lot of people don't have. I mean, just like you're saying, people are questioning, why would you go on such a long flight? But then we've seen that, you know, you've got these conflict zones in Europe with Ukraine, then you've got in the Middle East, these things that are kicking off. And it's not that flights can't still get through those areas. It's just that they create enough question to where maybe people would pay that extra to say, look, I just don't want to think about it. If I get on this flight, it avoids that entire zone. So some of these flights with Project Sunrise will just zoom over the Pacific up, you know, up across Canada, up over the North Pole, down to the UK, just avoiding all of this. And so if you've got the money, if you've got the concern, and, you know, it's an option. And I think that, you know, it really is. It's a solution that was in search of a problem. Well, now it has the problem. And the problem is what's going on in the Middle East.
And you'd be happy to hop on, Chris?
Well, I guess if it's a matter of, you know, doing my job, reporting this, I guess.
That's right. And maybe not forking out that extra 20% yourself.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is a daunting amount of time. And yet, I mean, you know, people would have said the same thing about flights between here and Brisbane, you know, once upon a time. So,
yes.
It's progress.
Back in the old days. Exactly. Chris Zappone, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
Chris Zappone is aviation writer for The Age. Neil says, worst thing on 24-hour flight, kids, and more kids. I guess that's true. Maybe if it isn't your kids, or maybe if it is. Tell me what you think. David in Anglesey, we've been talking about the attractions that might give people cause to come to where you live. Tell me about the unofficial attractions where you live.
Oh, well, Mary, we've got all the birds, particularly the king parrots are great. I have a family or a flock.
They're not 4 metres tall.
Thankfully not, because they often land on my head and my shoulders.
Oh, good.
They have a great relationship with my dog. We have, of course, all the other birds and native birds. We have kangaroos just lazing around in the streets.
Oh, this is Anglesey.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
yeah.
Terrific.
They're very common on the golf course, which isn't far from me, but often in the afternoons and during the night, they'll be just outside on the nature strips.
So, David, I'm making a day trip from Melbourne. Basically, this is the sort of thing I can expect in Anglesey at any time?
Absolutely, yep.
How do you feel living there?
Oh, it's fantastic. I've been here 42 years now. I absolutely love it.
What do you come to Melbourne for then, David?
Not much. And today's a beautiful day, even though it's only 8 degrees or so and it's quite windy. Rain and hail, we're getting rainbows and sunshine every now and again. So, yeah, it's a pretty special spot to live.
Oh, David, well done on picking that special spot. And, yep, you've just put Anglesey again on one of those day trip lists that I keep wanting to get back to. Keep those calls coming, like David, 1300 222 774, if you'd like to show off about the place you've picked and the attractions that maybe other people should come to visit you for. Paul in Gisborne says, the 24-hour flight is not for me. I doubt I'd be able to walk off after 24 hours. I am also with you, Paul. You definitely need that area to stretch. You're with 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. This is The Conversation Hour. And I tell you what, the talk of athletics, is the Commonwealth Games, of course. We've had a lot of glory on the fields and the track in Glasgow. Let's get up to date with some of our sprinting heroes overnight.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
We are talking about an Australian team. We always know that they carry so much hope and they most often deliver when it comes to Commonwealth Games. But overnight, you might not have heard, two national records smashed. in the 100 metres. Torrey Lewis won bronze, running under 11 seconds for the first time, breaking her national record with a time of 10.99. Lockie Kennedy won silver with a new national record of 9.85. The first man to break 9.93, which was the Patrick Johnson's previous mark, which had stood since 2003. Torrey Lewis, of course, her record hadn't lasted since the semis. So she's just smashing her own record as she goes. We're picking out those two from obviously a lot that's happened overnight, all the gold raining down on Australia in Glasgow as well. But to take us through it, Craig Pickering is the Director of Performance Sustainability at Australian Athletics. He's joining us from the US, and we'll get to why in just a moment. But thank you, Craig, for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Craig, I'm talking about, as I say, Lockie Kennedy and Torrey Lewis. First off to Lockie Kennedy, how significant is his achievement? He was just off the gold. But, of course, setting a national record that had stood since 2003, breaking that record, what does that mean?
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, in terms of 9.85 on the global stage, that's more than good enough to start winning medals at major championships, Olympics, World Championships, that sort of thing. So it's a huge breakthrough for him, and I think it just sets the stage for Australian sprinters in the future as well.
And, of course, we know about Gaut and Rowan Browning. We've got so much talent there as well, pushing him?
Yeah, we have. We've got loads. I mean, even in terms of men's sprint in general, we had another guy in the final, Eddie Nketiah, who's just recently come across from New Zealand. So that was great. We had three in the semi-finals of the men's, three in the semi-finals of the women as well. So really strong showing there. And then even at the under 20 level, we've got a lot of promising athletes coming through as well, like Gaut, who you mentioned.
Yes, Eddie was sixth in 10.06, as you say. Is that, you know, we used to, as I say, glory at the Commonwealth Games. But what is the reason behind this current surge? Is it about the fact of people being pushed by their compatriots, or is it something else?
It's definitely the case of competition, like you said. I mean, something we've done as an organisation in the last couple of years is really start to focus on our relay programme. So trying to get those teams competitive at the world stage. And what that does is it allows us to support those athletes financially. They get the coaching they need, they get the performance support they need. And that really helps them, I guess, get to the level they're at. And then because we've got so much competition for places into the relay team and into the individual spots as well, it just means everyone has to raise their game, and I guess we're seeing the benefits of that now.
Mm. Torrey Lewis is in her own right such a superstar. She's won bronze, the first medal in this event in 28 years. What would you have to say about Torrey Lewis?
Yeah, just incredible. I mean, you've seen Torrey break the Australian record in the last couple of weeks, a couple of times. She's definitely been progressing towards this kind of level, but to make that breakthrough, go under 11 seconds for the first time and hold a nerve in the final, I think that's the next step for her, which is fantastic.
You're listening to Craig Pickering. He is Director of Performance Sustainability at Australian Athletics. And you're coming to us from Oregon, Craig. Tell us why.
So I'm here for the World Under 20 Championships, which are here next week. And it's the third time I've done this. I was here with Lockie 4 years ago with the World Under 20s. Then we're in Colombia. And then I was with Torrey 2 years ago in Peru as well. So I've got plenty of time with these athletes, and hopefully we'll find the next star in this championships as well.
Exactly. World Athletics Under 20 Championships. You've got a team of 72 athletes. I'm not going to sort of make you compare, but in your time with Australian Athletics, what would you say about the calibre of this up-and-coming group?
Oh, they're amazing. I mean, it's the biggest team we've ever sent away to these championships, which builds on the biggest team we had 2 years ago. So every time these championships come around, we're picking more and more athletes to compete on a global stage, which I think is really impressive in terms of shows we've got a competitive depth on that front. And then 2 years ago, we had the best World Under 20 Championships Australia have ever had in terms of medals and top eight. So shows that the caliber of athletes is there, and we'll hopefully go close again to that this time.
You said that you actually had Lockie and Torrey competing in those World Relay Championships as a team manager. You were there. What do you think is about their attitudes that are really propelling them ahead?
They're both just unbelievable competitive animals. Like, they're really nice on TV, but if you see them behind the scenes, they really want to win. They've got that competitive drive, which is really important. And then something else they're really good at is just when the pressure's on, they can keep their heads, they can keep cool and calm and just focus on what they need to do. And that's something they've both got and have managed to develop over the years, and that's what set them up for success here.
You're listening to Craig Pickering, who's Director of Performance Sustainability at Australian Athletics. And we've only got a couple of days. Is it just a day left, I believe, of the athletics at the Games?
I reckon we finish it on Saturday, so it's probably Saturday. Three more days.
Three more days. What else should we be looking out for, Craig?
Well, I'm the men's 4x1 relay coach, so I'd say that. They race on Saturday, and that team should do quite well. But the women's relay team will also do pretty well, I thought. We've got the pole vault coming up, so we've got Nina Kennedy and Curtis Marshall there, both ranked very highly in the world. Matt Denny in the discus as well. And then the men's eight is shaping up really nicely. We've got three through from there. We've got Peter Bowles probably the pick of those as well. So there's still a lot more good athletes to come through yet.
And yes, we shouldn't forget the field events. Eleanor Patterson winning her second Commonwealth Games gold medal in the high jump as well. And, you know, so we always, as I say, it's almost a glamour sport, the athletics versus the field, but we're going so well there as well.
Yeah, we are. No, it was fantastic. Eleanor and second as well from Nicola. So 1-2 in the women's high jump there, which is really good and just underlines the dominance of those two athletes have had in the last couple of years, really.
Well, Craig, best of luck at the under-20s, and we want to hear about all of those up-and-coming stars, and we'll be looking out. When does that start?
That starts on Wednesday next week.
Wednesday next week. Craig, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Craig Pickering, Director of Performance Sustainability at Australian Athletics. Thank you for joining me on the Conversation Hour today. Join me again tomorrow.